This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor, Gaius, and I welcome Michael Vlahos of Johns Hopkins Germanicus. It is Londinium on a Saturday afternoon evening. We're drinking our cup of wine, and when we finish, our philosophizing, we will hie to the amphitheater for the evening's entertainment. This is 90 AD. We do not have electronics here in 90 AD, but we do have live acts that come through regularly from Rome and the provinces. Sometimes they're Roman farces, which I enjoy. Sometimes they're Greek dramas, which Germanicus loves. Always a proverb, always teaching. However, the philosophizing we're doing right now is something that's come in over these last days from word of mouth all the way from Rome. Rumors of war, not the ordinary wars of our Emperor Domitian, who is popular with the people but unpopular with the Senate. No, these are rumors of war in the 21st century. We can see forward, and the rumors of war have grown over these last weeks to a point right now that there is no guessing anymore. There are facts, such as cyber attacks launched against Ukraine by, we can presume, the hirelings of the Russian Federation, such as demands, almost at this point, ultimatums issued by the Russian Foreign Ministry, such as you will roll back NATO's military infrastructure to 1997, such as Russia must act to protect itself. We don't trust you. You'll forward-based missiles. These ultimatums are voiced not only in face-to-face between the Russian Foreign Ministry and the American State Department, but also in the councils of Brussels, at NATO meetings in which Russian officers are present in their big-chested uniforms, and at the OSCE meeting in Vienna. This organization mirrors much of the EU in terms of monitoring the crisis in Ukraine. These are genuine ultimatums. And before I turn to Germanicus, who observes these rumors of war, I remind all of us that we here in Londinium remember Boudicca. We remember what war is. Perhaps the American State Department and the Russian Foreign Ministry have forgotten momentarily. I read from a new assessment of the Boudiccan War and what it meant to Rome, 60 AD. The Boudiccan War in Britain was one of the most violent and destructive conflicts in Roman military history. This time it was the rebels who meted out violence on civilians, and the destruction of Colchester, London, and St. Albans provided a particularly graphic topic for Roman historians keen to depict barbarians as reckless maniacs. Cassius Dio's time, when Tacitus had referred to as killing, gibbets, fire, and crosses, had been suitably elaborated, though there may have been some truth in what he wrote. And he wrote, what he wrote was, I'm not going to read, about how the Boudiccan rebels treated the Roman citizens, especially the women. The violence was conducted against a backdrop of sacrifices, banquets, and wanton behavior. Now, when Rome settled this dispute, it also treated the tribes of Britain with equal savagery. So there is no moral high ground here. The Roman army was unleashed in payback. That is the nature of conflict, especially in the European continent, which is what we're now contemplating. So I turn to you, Germanicus. These rumors of war, almost at times it feels like a chess game in which the Kremlin, wielding the all-powerful knight, continues to put the NATO forces in check, or check warning in some fashion. I won't use the chess metaphor too much, but the Russians do enjoy it. At this point, how do you measure these rumors of war? Is Washington finding a way to talk about this without confronting Russia? Is Russia finding a way to talk about this without acting in Ukraine? Good evening to you.
Good evening, Gaius. The whole idea of rumors of war as a trope, or as a term of art, is actually more worrisome or troubling than the actual war that will ensue eventually. The rumors of war tell us, or should tell us, rather, that we are still entertaining the possibility of conflict in terms of preferred fantasies. We like certain fantasies about American and allied strength, about the eternal bonds between the U.S. and NATO, and how we've endured any sort of upheaval, and how we will punish and defeat our adversaries. An entire narrative, almost a sacred narrative, that goes back decades and decades. And, you know, for all the fact that the U.S. suffered a stinging defeat, a strategic defeat of proportions which will, in the decades to come, become all the more of a scepter, I think, a specter on our image of ourselves in Afghanistan. Nonetheless, like Rome, the U.S. has not really had to suffer a defeat in a big war or to be involved in a big war on the European continent. And if we look at Rome, you know, which is to say ourselves, in the period at the end of Augustus, the divine Augustus reign, what we see is a Rome that had not been truly challenged for several generations, from the, you know, the period of Germanicus in triumph, savaging the tribes in across the Rhine Germany, to the conquest of Britain. And so when the revolt of Boudica occurred, then to be followed just a few years after by the Jewish revolt in 70, Rome was not prepared and would not be in a position to have taken truly seriously the rumors that something was brewing. And the United States, in terms of the Ukrainian crisis, has for years, perhaps even decades now, since the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. has not taken Russia seriously. And each succeeding president, with the possible exception of Mr. Trump, but nonetheless, from Clinton on to Biden, American presidents have almost officially, certainly publicly, characterized Russia as a has-been former great power, no longer world power, just a regional power, third world country with nuclear weapons. These are these are insulting epithets. These are shameful insults in the sense that they create only more resentment and stoke more anger among Russians and make Russians more determined that we and NATO as a whole will at some point give them the respect that they deserve, and also that they require in order for their own security and their own sense of national identity and completeness. So there is a lot on the line right now, and they are telling us in so many words explicitly, moment to moment, just how much on the line everything is. And yet we are still preserving and sort of frolicking in these fantasies that somehow if we stand together, stay strong, do not concede, then Russia will not move. We will deter. We will make them stand down. We will force them. And if Russia does act like an upstart and does act, we have the power to punish them and ultimately to bring down Russia's power, in other words, to shame and humiliate them even more.
A detail, Germanicus. As far as I understand, the threats, if that's what it is, the warnings from the State Department turned entirely on money, on the price that you will pay. I do not believe they spoke of the price in blood. They spoke in the price of treasure, such and such a banking sanction, such and such a sanction on oil. All of that meaning that Russia will pay for this. I don't remember, but I'm pretty clear that the Russian people over the last 100 years have paid everything several times during the Soviet period, certainly during the Second War. And there was never a hesitation to pay more, never a hesitation to be poverty-stricken because the myth in Russia is that the motherland must be protected. I don't know that the State Department is taking that into account.
That is true. And the payment that the Russians have made is, in the deepest recesses, metaphorically, of the Russian mind, very much equivalent to the tribute that Russia had to pay when it was under the Mongol yoke, and then later, you know, suffering under the Tatars in the south and the Ottomans, et cetera, et cetera. So, oh, even the Poles. So, yes, there is that sense of Russia facing a future. And this is not just Putin's imagination, where Russians generally recoil at the thought that they're facing a future in which they are essentially, again, a tribute country. In other words, that they must behave according to American rules, kowtow to American power, and essentially occupy a subordinate position in the firmament of nations, lower than Germany, lower even than Poland. This is absolutely unacceptable. Now, as to the issue of using military power, the issue of blood, no, we have not officially said anything about that. In fact, the president has said that we will not go to Ukraine's aid militarily. However,
Germanicus, as I'm going to stop you here because you've made me aware in these last days of that there is a threat, a military threat, an asymmetrical military threat directed against Russia if it moves. I overlooked that when I said that we've not threatened anything in terms of blood. So if you'll just pause a moment, when we come back, we'll turn to the blood threat that Russia will pay if. This is Germanicus, Michael Vlahos. I'm Gaius, John Batchelor. This is the Friends of History Debating Society in Londinium. Rumors of war from the frontiers, far from us. However, we debate what's next.